Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. I am filling in for Renee Giacchino, who was unable to host today's program. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 623-1330. We have with us on the line Bob Levy, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies and a member of the Board of Directors for the Cato Institute. Welcome to Your Turn, Mr. Levy.
Nice to be with you.
I appreciate you joining us. We're going to be talking about the Heller v. D.C. case. This is formerly known as the Parker v. D.C. case. Name got changed, but the good news is, well, is it good news? Depends on the outcome. The Supreme Court has decided to take the case, and that is going to determine, is the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, an individual right, or is it a right granted to the states or militias or only to those that the Attorney General feels like ought to have it? Well, anybody with half a brain who paid half attention knows it's an individual right, but we are dealing with the government here, so I'm not so confident in the outcome. But let's find out first what the case is about. Bob, how'd you get involved with this? Because the Cato Institute doesn't do any kind of litigation directly, so how did you come about in your participation with this case in Washington, D.C.?
Of course, my work at Cato is all involved with constitutional issues. Second Amendment is certainly a part of that, maybe not a big part, but it's a part, and we perceived that an opportunity existed in Washington, D.C. for a number of reasons. One is that Washington, D.C. has the most draconian gun ban in all of the country. The rules are, and this is hard to imagine, but there is an absolute ban on handguns anywhere in D.C. You can't have handguns in your home, any home. And it doesn't apply to just felons or kids or crazy people. It applies to ordinary, upstanding citizens. And that's been in effect for 31 years. If you happen to have a handgun in 1976, when this all first started, it got grandfathered. But you can't carry that handgun from room to room in your own home without a permit, and D.C. hasn't granted a permit in 31 years. If you happen to have a shotgun or a rifle, you can keep those in your home. But they have to be unloaded and then either disassembled or trigger locked. So, in effect, nobody in Washington, D.C. can have a functional firearm in their home to defend themselves. So that was one good reason. Another good reason is that Washington, D.C.'s crime rate is among the highest in the country. Off and on, D.C. has reclaimed its title as the nation's murder capital. So you put those two things together, a high crime rate and a draconian gun controls, and it suggests that D.C. is an appropriate venue. And also, it's an appropriate venue because it's not a state, and there is a knotty question that remains unresolved in the courts, and that is whether the Second Amendment, however it's interpreted, whether it applies to the states. Originally, the Bill of Rights was deemed to apply only to the federal government. Most of the Bill of Rights since the Civil War have been incorporated, that is to say, made to apply to the states. But that issue regarding the Second Amendment hasn't been resolved. Fortunately, D.C. is not a state, and we didn't have to come to grips with that. And then finally, D.C. is where the federal government lives, and that makes D.C. very important, because if your Second Amendment rights, if you think your rights are being violated by federal law, no matter where that violation occurs, you can sue in D.C., because D.C. is the seat of government. Wherever the defendant lives, that's an appropriate place to sue. So that created an opportunity for the first time since the ban was implemented. Add to that a couple of recent developments. First, an outpouring of scholarship from the left, from liberals, that acknowledge now that the Second Amendment does secure an individual right. And then there was a case in 2001 down in Texas called United States v. Emerson, which held that the Second Amendment secured an individual right. And that was the first federal appellate court to come to that conclusion among all of the federal appellate courts that had considered the Second Amendment. So all of those things taken together suggested that it was a good time to challenge the D.C. handgun ban.
Now, for those who are following the Parker case, since renamed the Heller case, can you tell us why the name changed when the Supreme Court got it?
It's a complicated legal doctrine in everywhere, but in particularly complicated in D.C. It's called standing. You have to be able to show that you have been injured in order to file a lawsuit. And in D.C., the standards for showing injury are very difficult to meet. You may recall when we had the assault weapons ban back in 1994, the assault weapons ban covered semi-automatic weapons with more than a certain number of rounds in the magazine and a couple of other features like bayonet mounts or whatever. And a company called Navigar made a weapon that that qualified and therefore was banned under the assault weapons ban, and they tried to challenge the assault weapons ban on Second Amendment grounds. And D.C. said, nope, you can't file suit to challenge. And why not? Because the assault weapons ban did not mention the specific weapon that Navigar manufactured. It did say semi-automatic weapons with more than X rounds in the magazine and certain features, and indeed Navigar's weapon met those characteristics, but because the statute didn't specifically name the weapon by name that Navigar manufactured, Navigar was thrown out of court. And the conclusion was Navigar hadn't shown a sufficiently credible and imminent threat of prosecution. Well, applying that doctrine, the Court of Appeals threw out the claims of five of our six plaintiffs. These were plaintiffs who said that they wanted to have a gun in their home, and D.C. said, well, that's not enough, because while if you do have a gun in your home, D.C. may decide to prosecute you, maybe they won't. And so the threat of prosecution is not sufficiently credible or imminent.
So what was the
one of our plaintiffs,
with Heller?
Dick Heller, the only one surviving, and that's why the case is now called Heller, actually applied in D.C. for a registration of a handgun, and he was turned down. And it was that turn down, it was his rejection, that was in fact his injury. It didn't matter whether he was ever prosecuted for illegally owning a gun or whether he in fact ever did illegally own a gun. He was turned down, and therefore he was injured. Of course, you know, the natural reaction is, well, why didn't we do that for everybody? Have them go apply for a permit. It's catch-22 in Washington, D.C. In order to apply for a registration of a handgun, you have to prove that you own a handgun. Well, how do you get one? You can't buy one in D.C. And you can't buy one out of state because federal law says the only place you can buy a handgun is the state where you reside. So not having a handgun means you can't apply. Now, fortunately, Heller used to live outside of D.C., and he bought a gun then. He couldn't bring it into D.C., but he could bring in the paperwork. So he could prove that he had the gun. And he applied to register that gun, which he had bought before he moved to D.C., and he was turned down. So that's a long answer to why it used to be Parker, and now it's Heller.
Okay, well, it's an interesting answer. I knew it had standing, but I was unaware of why the others were thrown out for lack of standing. Let me ask you a question. You had mentioned earlier that this is really unique because Washington, D.C. is not a state. And there's some question about the doctrine of incorporation and whether the Second Amendment has been incorporated to include the state's prohibition against banning any kind of arms.
Yes.
Why doesn't the 14th Amendment, just by its statement that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, why can't one simply say, the right to keep and bear arms, and I understand it's a right, not a privilege, but the right to keep and bear arms is one that I, as a U.S. citizen, has, so how can any state infringe upon that? Why doesn't the 14th Amendment automatically incorporate that?
Well, maybe it does, but there was a case in 1886 called Presser v. Illinois, and it said that the Second Amendment, and I quote from the case, is a limitation only upon the power of Congress and the national government, not the states. So Presser hasn't been overturned. There's a string of cases. After Presser, the entire incorporation question was litigated after Presser. But that string of cases never got around to the Second Amendment. It addressed almost all of the other amendments, but not the Second. So while Presser may be bad law, and as you say, maybe the 14th Amendment does incorporate the Second Amendment, the court has never formally ruled that, And because the court hasn't spoken to that question, as of now, Presser is still on the books. And that'll have to be another issue that's litigated, even if we win in D.C., in the Supreme Court, and even if the Supreme Court decides that the Second Amendment does secure an individual right, there will have to be a follow-on case to make sure that the Second Amendment applies to the states. My guess is it's a foregone conclusion that the Second Amendment will apply to the states just as the other amendments in the Bill of Rights, but there hasn't been a formal declaration to that end by the Supreme Court.
Well, any clear reading of the Second Amendment, the right of the people, it doesn't say the right of the states. It is clearly an individual right. The people is used when the people is intended, and the states is used when the states is intended. The Tenth Amendment, that's just to pick one that uses both. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. They clearly are not synonyms. So what's the danger that the Supreme Court's going to misinterpret this, as personally I believe they've done on many other cases, McCain-Feingold being one of them? When that went to the Supreme Court, I had the attitude of, well, Bush shouldn't have signed it, but it'll clearly be overturned. Well, the Supreme Court upheld it. I was stunned. Yeah. There was no way they could uphold McCain-Feingold as constitutional. If the First Amendment meant anything, it was for political speech, but they upheld the law. I'm frankly real concerned that we may get the same flawed decision out of this Supreme Court and then really throw a monkey wrench into this whole Second Amendment issue.
Yeah. Well, believe me, we're concerned as well. And there was a lot of debate in the gun rights community as to whether the timing was right to go for Supreme Court review. And there were a number of major players who thought this was a very bad idea. And I hope that after the fact, it turns out that they were wrong, but I don't dismiss the possibility that the Supreme Court could do what they did in the McConnell v. FEC case, the McCain-Feingold case that you mentioned, and really come down with an absolutely atrocious decision. But I think it's important to remember a couple of things. One is that 10 out of 12 judicial circuits, federal judicial circuits, all except the Texas case that I told you about, United States v. Emerson, and now Washington, D.C., 10 out of 12 judicial circuits have said that there's no individual. That means 47 states, all except Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, are in circuits where there is, in federal court, no individual right under the Second Amendment. Now, those decisions couldn't be any worse. And even if the Supreme Court goes the wrong way on the Heller case, those decisions are already on the books. They say there's no individual right. So if the Supreme Court says it over again, there's no change in those 47 states. And the other side of the picture is that there are 44 states under their state constitutions and state statutes that recognize an individual right. So those provisions do not rest on the Second Amendment. And even if the Supreme Court gets the Second Amendment wrong, there's nothing stopping states from granting rights that the federal government doesn't recognize. The federal constitution establishes a minimum, but not a maximum. So it's always possible for states to say, yes, there is an individual right under our version of the Second Amendment in our state constitution, even if the Supreme Court says there is none. So all would not be lost if the Supreme Court went the wrong way, although quite clearly we are hoping for and are cautiously optimistic about a Supreme Court decision that goes the right way. That's not to say there's no risk involved.
Well, my analysis shows Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas voting correctly, Bader Ginsburg, Breyer, Souter, Stevens incorrectly, and Kennedy being the swing vote, and there's no telling which way it'll go.
Well, I mean, that's the conventional wisdom, that it's a 4-4 split on just ideological grounds, and Kennedy's the swing vote. But we're very hopeful that it's not going to come down that way, that, in fact, we can get even more than five votes. Bear in mind that there's a lot of scholarship out there now. And again, a lot of it's from very respected people on the left, people like Akhil Amar and Alan Dershowitz and Larry Tribe. These are people with impeccable liberal credentials. And they have concluded that the Second Amendment does secure an individual right. And it's very interesting to note how the Supreme Court couched this case. There was a dispute between D.C. and ourselves as to what is the question that the Supreme Court should be addressing. D.C., very dishonestly, I think, couched the question this way, and you'll hear how silly this is. The question should be, said D.C., for the Supreme Court to review, isn't it okay for D.C. to ban handguns since D.C. allows rifles and shotguns? Now, of course, we know that D.C. doesn't allow rifles and shotguns unless you're going to take the rifle and club somebody over the head with it. If you're going to use it as a gun, D.C. doesn't allow it because as soon as you load it, you've broken the law. That's the way D.C. put the question. We said that the question should be whether the Second Amendment guarantees law-abiding adult individuals a right to keep ordinary functional firearms, including handguns, in their homes. So we couched the question as whether or not there was an individual right. Interestingly, the Supreme Court took just about all of what we wanted, but went even a little bit further. The Supreme Court said this is what it's going to address. And, of course, the court's determination of the question is dispositive. It doesn't matter what we want or what D.C. wants. It's what the court decides it's going to address. The court's question is whether the D.C. Code violates, and now I'm quoting, the Second Amendment rights of individuals who are not affiliated with any state-regulated militia but who wish to keep handguns and other firearms for private use in their homes. It's interesting that it said the Second Amendment rights of individuals. It didn't say, does the Second Amendment secure an individual right, and if so, is that right violated by the D.C. Code? It didn't say, does the D.C. Code violate the Second Amendment rights of individuals, if any? It said, does the Second Amendment, does the D.C. Code violate the Second Amendment rights of individuals, almost presuming that there were such rights. So that might suggest, I don't want to read too much into this, and it's always difficult to interpret where the court's going with all of this. It might suggest that really what they're going to focus on is what types of regulations are going to be permitted under an individual rights view of the Second Amendment.
And we will talk about what those restrictions may be when Your Turn continues on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. I'm filling in today for Renee Giacchino. With us on the line is Bob Levy with the Cato Institute. He is a senior fellow in constitutional studies and serves on the board of directors for the Cato Institute. 623-1330 is the number if you have a question. Jim, it's your turn.
Yeah, how you doing, guys? Hey, I think this is the right time for the Supreme Court to take this decision up. I really do. I think that the judges we have on there would give the right balance to this. Now, I would like your take, however, on this retrial of the customs agents. I could not believe that they actually had a 10-year sentence on the gun charges. Here's law enforcement officers with gun charges against them, federal gun charges, and they're federal law enforcement officers.
Bob, do you have an opinion on that Campos and Romeo?
I'm sorry,
case?
I haven't looked closely at that, and I just don't want to get involved in something I'm not familiar with.
Okay, that's fine. Jim, I appreciate the call. Bob, I want to ask a question in terms of which way this thing can go. If the Supreme Court rules that the right of the people to keep and bear arms does mean the people, and they can keep and bear arms, that's great. I'm happy, and so are those who believe in gun rights and the Second Amendment and the Constitution. But if they rule that it's not an individual right, Katie bar the door, there's no telling what the anti-gun left will do. What happens, though, if instead of one way or the other, they cut the baby in half and say, yeah, well, it's a right, but it is subject to reasonable restrictions, then what?
Well, even Judge Silberman, in his opinion for the D.C. Circuit, which did declare that there was an individual right secured by the Second Amendment, suggested that that right is not absolute. And so he said, well, maybe, he didn't have to decide this, but he said maybe D.C. could justify concealed carry restrictions and registration requirements and proficiency testing and keeping guns away from certain kinds of people. I think it's quite clear that Second Amendment rights are not absolute, and Silberman is right about that. For example, some weapons can be regulated, Stinger missiles, for example, and some people can be regulated, let's say six-year-olds, and some uses, let's say murder, can be regulated. And just that's the case with the First Amendment. You know, the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law regarding freedom of speech and religion. But we know there are laws passed all the time. There are restrictions on shouting fire in a crowded theater, on incitement to riot, on advertising, on obscenity, on defamation, on disturbing the peace. These are all restrictions on free speech. And yet, despite the fact that the amendment says Congress shall pass no law, there are laws. So this issue will boil down to whether or not certain regulations are permissible. But the important thing is, once Congress decides it's an individual right, then the level of court review is ratcheted up. If it's just a collective right, you never even get to the point where you ask whether or not there are a restriction is reasonable. But once there's an individual right, then the court is going to scrutinize whether or not that right can be compromised, just as the court scrutinizes compromises on the First Amendment. Sometimes they get it wrong, like they did with the campaign finance case, but more often than not, rigorous court scrutiny means that not only do you have to have a legislature approve of a regulation, but the court has to chime in and say, yeah, that's compatible with the Constitution.
Very quickly, we've only got 20 seconds left. When will this be heard, and when can we expect a ruling?
Briefing starts in January. It'll probably be oral argument in March, and we can expect a ruling, my guess is, by June 30th, end of the term.
One way or another, we look forward to it. Bob, I appreciate you coming on the program.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Thank you. That was Bob Levy, a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. Stay tuned, because there is more Your Turn after Top of the Hour CNN here on 1330 WEBY.